Well, thank you very much, Bernie. Song of Songs is an intriguing book, 8 chapters in the middle of the Old Testament. To read it with one voice is difficult because it's laid out in parts, one part, two parts, and then a chorus. So rather than just read it myself, Sharon, now I need to emphasize straight away that Sharon is my wife, okay? That is very important for you to understand. Rather than go through a whole chapter or something, we've selected verses that represent the two parts in the book. So bear with us as we go through this together. Sharon.
Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for your love is more delightful than wine. I am a rose of Sharon, a lily of the valleys. He has taken me to his banqueting table, and his banner over me is love. Daughters of Jerusalem, I charge you by the gazelles and by the does of the field, do not arise or awaken love unto it so desires.
How beautiful you are, my darling. Oh, how beautiful. Your eyes are doves. Like a lily among thorns is my darling among the young women. My dove in the cleft of the rock, in the hiding places on the mountainside, show me your face. Let me hear your voice, for your voice is sweet and your face is lovely.
My beloved is mine and I am his. Place me like a seal over your heart, like a seal on your arm. For love is as strong as death. Many waters cannot quench love. Rivers cannot wash it away.
You have stolen my heart, my sister, my bride. You have stolen my heart with one glance of your eyes, with one jewel of your necklace. How beautiful is your love, my sister, my bride. How much more pleasing is your love than wine, and the fragrance of your perfume than any spice. All beautiful you are, my darling. There is no flaw in you.
Daughters of Jerusalem, I charge you by the gazelles and by the does of the field, do not arise or awaken love until it so desires.
Well, thank you for the opportunity of coming this evening. It's a nice chance to be able to dive into a book of scripture and look in some detail at it, and I hope you'll bear with me. I've produced some notes for the end, so you'd be welcome at the end to come and collect one and take one away, and it tries to cover most of the points I'm covering tonight, and we'll have question and answers at the end. Can I just say at the outset as well, If some people feel a little uncomfortable with the subjects that we're looking at, then I understand that, and I hope I don't cause embarrassment from some of the things that we say, and if so, I apologise in advance. I don't quite know where I obtained this book from. It is a rather dilapidated copy. I was a very young Christian. It was one of the first books I ever bought or obtained, was given, I don't know what. It's by a lady called Adelaide Newton. Fourth edition, this one was written in 1856. It's Adelaide Newton's summary of the Song of Songs, or the Song of Solomon it's sometimes called. And as a young Christian, I got hold of this book. I'd read the Song of Songs. I'd puzzled over it. I couldn't understand it. And then I picked up Adelaide Newton's commentary. And at the time, when I picked up this commentary, I thought, this is wonderful. This is amazing, because Adelaide Newton, in her commentary, was giving a whole new meaning to this Old Testament book that I'd never seen before at all. She says that the book is full of Jesus. She says, Jesus not as saviour, not as high priest, not as judge, but as the beloved, the bridegroom. The book, she says, is about the marriage union between Christ, the bridegroom, and his bride, the church. And she goes on to explore that and the relationship between Christ and the individual believer. The verse that particularly fascinated me, and I thought this is amazing, is chapter 1 and verse 5, where the woman in the story says, "Dark I am, yet lovely. Dark I am, yet lovely, O daughters of Jerusalem." "Ah, yes," says Adelaide Newton, "dark I am indeed. I am full of sin. I have gone wrong in my life. I am full of sin. I am steeped in sin. I am dark in the eyes of the Lord. But thanks be to God, through Jesus Christ, I have been covered by the blood of the Lamb. Therefore, he looks upon me not as dark. He looks upon me as lovely and delightful in his eyes. And it's all because of Jesus." And I read this and thought, wow! Isn't that wonderful? And she goes on with other things, and I'll pick up some of those a little bit later on. Now, what I didn't know at the time was what I was reading in Adelaide Newton was an allegory. It was an allegorization of the text. The plain sense of the text, if you read the 8 chapters of Song of Songs, it is evidently and clearly a love song between a man and a woman, or several love songs between a man and a woman. But what Adelaide Newton was doing was providing an allegory, saying this represents something else. This points to something else. And what I subsequently discovered is that the allegorization of Song of Songs is actually the way that it has nearly always been handled, going back 3 centuries into the Old Testament era, as well as the New Testament era. It has been the allegorization of the text that has been at the front and the foremost of the ways of handling this material. And this for a very good reason. Because there would have been many then, as there are many now, who read those 8 chapters and they are embarrassed. Because as you read it, it is full of very uncomfortable, embarrassing reading. Words, phrases, things. What you have here is a book that is not the norm in terms of spiritual reading. It is not the normal thing you would have in a book of religion at all. And so people have felt uncomfortable with the text and have wanted, if I can use this phrase, to cover it up. They have felt it full of shame, and therefore it needed clothing. And so they've clothed it. And they've filled it with meaning that isn't there in the text, but they filled it with meaning because they thought, well, it's a way of making it respectable in polite society. I need to add as well, and one of the other reasons people have felt uncomfortable with the text is because you will find in the 8 chapters there's no mention of God. There's no mention of the people of God. There's no mention of any of the great themes of redemption, of salvation. There's no mention of the great ethical themes or social concerns. There's nothing about the worship of God. There are none of those things in there at all. It's completely absent. And so because there is this void of spiritual content, the commentators have had to try and fill it in. And they've had to add What isn't there in the plain meaning of the text? Song of Songs is, as I said, full of material that many of us feel a little uncomfortable with. And there are, let's face it, some what we might call raunchy passages. Take me away with you. Let us hurry. Let the king bring me into his chambers. His left arm is under my head. His right arm embraces me. There is sexual innuendo. There are euphemisms. Euphemisms for the sexual act that wouldn't be far away from something in the Carry On movies. Let my beloved come into his garden and taste its choice fruits. There are explicit descriptions of the female anatomy that we wouldn't normally have in polite society as well. That reading that Sharon and I read was a sanitized version. I very, very carefully selected the passages that we could say to each other without feeling too awkward. I avoided chapter 4, verse 5, and chapter 7, verse 3, which are doublets. They're the same thing. Your breasts are like two fawns, like twin fawns of a gazelle. You don't normally read that sort of thing in scriptural material. And so graphic are some of those things, that verse I've read to you there, so graphic are some of those things that the readers of old, the commentators of old, would have closed their ears and said, stop it, I can't read this, it's not polite, it's not right, it's not proper. And so they made it say something else. The Christian writer Hippolytus saw the two breasts as the Old and New Testaments that Christians feed upon. Richard Littledale, 19th century Christian writer, saw the two breasts as Mother Church nurturing her children. And Adelaide Newton, my friend Adelaide Newton there, says the two breasts seem to imply the idea of unity in the Church of Christ. More or less, there have been four main allegorical attempts to make sense of this book. Two of them from the Jewish world, two of them from the Christian world. And the first attempt to try and understand or add meaning to the Song of Songs from the Jewish rabbis, it was an attempt to see this as a song about the relationship between God and Israel. The twin breasts were sometimes seen as Moses and Aaron. Other times they were the two tablets of the Ten Commandments. The most ingenious allegorization in the Jewish world was that provided by the Targum of Song of Songs. Now, I need to explain a bit about that. The Old Testament was originally written in Hebrew. There came a period many centuries later where that language was obsolete within the Jewish world. Aramaic was being spoken. And so along came these writers in the 7th, 8th century AD, and they wrote commentaries of the Hebrew text in Aramaic, and they put a whole pan of explanations along with it. They're called Targums, and nearly all the books of the Old Testament have got these Targums. That's the Targum of the Song of Songs, or Canticles. It cost me an arm and a leg to get that. But it's absolutely fascinating. Basically what it does, it looks at the eight chapters, and it sees it as the story of Israel. And it sees each chapter as a period in the history of Israel. And so, for example, what have we got here? chapter 1, verse 4, the text says, text of Song of Songs, draw me after you, we will run. May the king bring me into his chambers. We will be glad and rejoice in you. We will recall our love for you more than wine. That's what the text says. This is what the Targum says. When the people of the house of Israel went out from Egypt, the Shekinah of the master of the world traveled before them in a pillar of cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night. The righteous of that generation said before the Lord of the world, draw us after you and we will run in the way of your goodness. Bring us near to the tent, to the foot of Mount Sinai, and give us your Torah from out of your heavenly treasury. Chapter 1, verse 5. Dark I am, yet lovely, O daughters of Jerusalem, dark as the tents of Kedar. That's what the text says. This is what the Targum says. When the people of the house of Israel made the calf, their faces became as dark as the sons of Cush who dwell in the tents of Kedar. But when they returned in repentance and were forgiven, the radiance of the glory of their faces became as great as the angels. Dark I am, yet lovely. And so it goes on in chapter 4. We're into the era of Solomon. Behold, you are beautiful, my love. Behold, you are beautiful. This is the Lord's response to the assembly of Israel after King Solomon offered 1,000 burnt offerings on the altar and found favor before God. Chapter 4, verse 3, your lips are like a thread of scarlet. The Targum says the lips of the high priest were making intercession in prayer before the Lord on the Day of Atonement. Chapter 5, I was asleep. House of Israel sinned and Lord gave over to Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and they went into exile. Chapter 6, verse 2, my beloved went down into his garden. The Lord goes down to Babylon to deliver the Israelites from captivity, and so on. It's an incredibly clever allegory of the text, but you have to ask the question, is that really what the text is trying to say? So we move into the Christian era and the two main Christian attempts of allegorizing Song of Songs. Well, I've indicated what those are already. The first one is that it's a song, a love song between Christ and the church, his beloved, his bride. The other one is that it's about the relationship between Christ and the individual believer. That's very much what Adelaide Newton was trying to do there. You have to understand the motivation, certainly when you come into the Christian era, the motivation. Why did they feel they needed to cover up the text? Why did they need to dress it up in these ways? And the plain and simple reason was they found the subject matter thoroughly distasteful. Early Christian fathers, Jerome, Saint Augustine, they were men who just felt totally at sea with anything to do with the body. They dwelt in a world that was dominated by a Platonist philosophy. The spirit is good, the flesh is bad. They had a weak and feeble understanding of creation and of human nature. They felt very uncomfortable with that. Some of these early Christian fathers, we call them ascetics, but what many of them would do, they tried to deny the body the things that the body was naturally requiring. So not only did they feel that sex was something that really was wrong, but they were very uncomfortable with food and with eating because they found that rather repulsive as well. And so many of the early Christian fathers would punish themselves by not eating for weeks on end because they felt that in doing this they were mastering the flesh and therefore were rising to the spirit. Now, if that's your mindset, if that's how you're approaching life, if that's how you're approaching things, then it wouldn't be surprising that you get a slightly unhealthy take on things. And hence, when it comes to subject matter like you find in the Song of Songs, they really would have been out of their depth completely. For Augustine, Marriage was a regrettable necessity. A regrettable necessity. It was needed for procreation, but that was all. That was okay, but you must not derive any pleasure from the sexual act, because if you do, that is sin. That was Augustine's teaching. That became the chief teaching of the Roman Catholic Church. Is there any wonder people finished up with neuroses? Is there any wonder people felt riddled with guilt and fear? Is there any wonder? And the Christian Church followed that up. The Christian Church for centuries perpetuated that guilt and fear and made people feel very uncomfortable about their bodies. It was a dreadful legacy that comes from a period where they were not at all comfortable with anything to do with our bodies and with our natural human self. Can I say as well that this tendency to allegorize the text, to cover the text, to make it say something else, to spiritualize the text, we might say, has come through into our Christian songbooks as well. We will on occasion sing songs in church, and I wish my voice was better, but he brought me to his banqueting table and his banner over me is love, is something that we have sung before, addressing the Lord. It's there in the Song of Songs. I am my beloved's and he is mine. I remembered one this afternoon as well. I will rejoice and you will be glad. I will taste your love more than wine. Draw me after you and we will run together. I will rejoice in you and be glad. Well, that's drawn from the Song of Songs as well. But it's not what the Song of Songs was about. The Song of Songs was about a man and a woman expressing their love for each other, their sexual love and desire for one another. That's what it was about. And it wasn't about trying to make it say something that the writers or the readers wanted it to say. So what I'm trying to argue, therefore, is that the allegorizing of the text, although it's understandable, and I've tried to explain the reasoning behind it, how uncomfortable people felt with the subject matter, although it was understandable, it's missed the point. Let's strip away the allegorizing attempts to interpret this passage. What, therefore, might Song of Songs be saying if it is to be taken at its face value? Slurp of water. Well, firstly, I think what it has to offer us is what I would call a theology of sexuality. In contradiction to the ascetics and the monks of the early Christian era, we have in these passages sexual passion and desire from the woman as well as from the man. And we're led to understand that this is perfectly normal and that this is good. That might not surprise some of you, but I think it's worth saying because of the taboo that's been on this subject for centuries, even within my lifetime, the uncomfortable way in which I remember somebody once gave me this book in a brown paper bag, just as we were getting married. Don't look at the front cover. I can't remember what it was called now, but it was something to do with love in marriage or whatever it was. Brown paper bag, cover it up. But Song of Songs, taken at its face value, is about passion and desire between a man and a woman. And therefore, there is a theology of sexuality in there that we need to hear and we need to take into our thinking in the way we approach these subjects. Secondly, I think it's got something to tell us about being human. You'll remember in the book of Genesis, chapter 1, where the writer is going through creation and God created this and God created that, and then he makes man in his own image, male and female, he created them. God blessed them and said, be fruitful and increase in number. And God saw what he had made, and behold, it was very good. How neglected is that verse? How neglected is that verse? God saw what he had made, and it was very good. He made male and female. He made them different. He made them with complementary sexual organs. And behold, that was very good. And yet, so often, we don't take that seriously enough. Duane Garrett, another one, big heavy tome, that's his commentary on Song of Songs and Lamentations. Why he's lumped the two of them together? Because they've not got a lot in common. But that's his commentary on Song of Songs. He says that if you look at the layout of the text in Song of Songs, he reckons that the first four chapters are, as it were, the courting couple. The man and the woman expressing love one for the other and desire for one another. But it's not until chapter 4, verse 16, that they actually, as it were, come together in marriage. And by chapter 5, then the fruit of married life and the abandon of married life is followed on from there. That's the structure as he sees it, this building up to chapter 4 and then moving away from chapter 5. But it's all about being human, and that there's no reason to feel uncomfortable about our humanity. There's no reason to feel ashamed of our body, of who we are, because we are made in the image of God. He has made us like this. He has made us with feelings, with desires. He has made us like this. That's what Genesis 1 is saying. And Song of Songs is merely sort of taking that a step further on as well. But let me just say, finally, another thing which is on my heart as well. And I don't want to get in trouble with the vicar. So he's at the back, and he'll tell me afterwards if I've strayed too far. If Song of Songs gives us a positive image of what it is to be human, if Song of Songs gives us a positive image of the sexual relationship between man and woman, the sexual desire between man and woman, if it does that, then I wonder if it's got something to contribute to an issue which for me is very important. And that's to do with what is often perceived to be in church circles, the conflict, the disparity between sexuality and holiness. In church life, we very often talk about being holy. And we say that this is very important. And we encourage people to walk in holy ways, to be holy people. Jesus was holy. We want everyone to be holy. That's good and that's right. But how we define holiness is so often about what we don't do. It's about not doing this. It's about not doing that. And yet somehow we've got to bring together the fact that while there is a commandment to be holy, there is within human beings sexual desire and sexual passion and sexual appetite. And you've got these two things which for centuries have been seen to be polar opposites. You can have the one You can have the other, but you can't have both. That's kind of what it's been. Indeed, if I can put it as simply as this, and I've put this in the notes because I thought it was very clever. For as long as the church has been around, sexual activity has been seen to be a product of the fall rather than of creation. That, to me, is the greatest mistake of all. Because in Genesis 1, it is clearly there as part of creation. The fall doesn't come until chapter 3. But for many, many, many of us in church, sexuality and holiness are polar opposites. And the result of that, it seems to me, is that very often it's a contributing factor to people falling away from church. We have children, they grow up in church. They become teenagers in church. And they are good and they're loyal and they enjoy coming. And then they get to a stage in their own development where they become sexually aware. And sometimes they become sexually active. And it's usually at that point that we lose them from church. And the reason we lose them is because they somehow feel that they have failed. They feel that they have fallen short. They feel that they have gone wrong. They feel that they have not kept promises that as children they had made. And therefore they cannot be worthy Christians. They cannot be worthy members. The desires that have overtaken them have, in their eyes at least, push them outside of the bounds of proper church. How crazy is that? How absolutely crazy is that? But that is what many of our young people have imbibed, either through teaching or through assumptions that have been made. And it strikes me that if we want to help the younger growing generation, and the older generation too, we have to be able to help those two things sit together in some harmony. That it is perfectly proper and perfectly possible to have sexual desire and sexual passion and sexual appetite, and at the same time be a Christian and striving to walk in the ways of Jesus and the ways of holiness. And unless we can hold those two things together comfortably, then we are not going to serve this generation or the next generation well. We will perpetuate the neuroses that have been imbibed and drawn in down through the centuries. Sexual desire and sexual expression are perfectly commensurate with a holy and godly life. And one of the things that concerns me most of all is that very often in our Christian teaching, where we teach about holiness, we are in grave danger of becoming hypocrites if we tell people one thing but actually feel and sense and know something completely different in our own hearts as well. And it's important that we become honest about who we are as people. It's important that we understand what goes on in our bodies and in our lives. It's important that we understand that and don't try and be false or prudish about it at all. But we understand that and we recognise that spirituality and holiness can sit alongside those things. That to me is something very important indeed. Now, that may have strayed beyond where the Song of Songs takes us, but it seems to me that the areas that the Song of Songs explores just bring up that kind of issue for us today as well. So the vicar will tell me afterwards if I've gone beyond where it was proper to go, because he's a good Anglican priest and I'm not. Well, look, that's my pennyworth on the Song of Songs. As I say, there are some notes here if people want to pick them up afterwards. It's covered wherever I could go with the material. There's lots of things I could have gone into but haven't. But it's really over to you now. Are there any questions, any thoughts, any observations? Try and be gentle and kind to me. If you've got eggs, then try and not to throw them. I'd be grateful. So. And bricks. I don't like bricks either.